Hello, everyone, and welcome back to New Books in Military History. This is Bob Wintermute. Today's interview is with Jacqueline Witt, and it's about her recent book, Bringing God to Men, American Military Chaplains and the Vietnam War. Dr. Witt is an assistant professor of strategy at the Air War College, which is part of the Air University at Maxwell Air Force Base, Montgomery, Alabama. She received her doctorate from the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, and in addition to her work at the Air University, she has taught courses at the United States Military Academy at West Point and serves on the Executive Committee for American Model United Nations. Jacqueline, welcome to New Books in Military History.
Great. Thanks so much. I'm glad to be here.
Great. As a Defense Department employee, you have to make a disclaimer, don't you?
Yes, this becomes part of my job. I should say I work for the Air Force, for the Department of Defense, but the book I published and all of the views I'm going to express here today are my own and do not reflect official policy of any of the organizations I am affiliated with otherwise.
Okay.
So that's done.
Okay, that's out of the way and we can proceed.
Absolutely.
Okay. Jackie, what prompted you to develop this project?
You know, I always think origin stories about books are really interesting, and I think this one has a fairly neat one. When I first went to graduate school, I thought in my head I was going to write about U.S. Military engagements and military assistance in the Cold War to Latin America. So that's what I went to grad school to do, to study, and I started writing about it the first year I was there. But then very quickly I discovered that I didn't actually like the topic that I thought I did and that I didn't want to do it anymore. And I couldn't imagine writing a dissertation on it, much less building a career on it. And so I went down to the basement of Davis Library, which is the library at UNC Chapel Hill, and I just started looking through the government documents there. I think that's testament to my historical sort of proclivities, is just go back to the documents. Mm-hmm. And I was basically shelf reading, and I came across a run of military professional journals from the Chaplain Corps. These happened to be from the 1980s, so just after the Vietnam War. And they were really interesting. They were talking about the transition to the all-volunteer force. They were talking about new challenges with young soldiers, drug abuse, family relationships, stress after the Vietnam War, and all of these things. And they were talking about how they were, as chaplains, going to deal with these pretty significant changes. And I thought they were simply interesting sort of historical artifacts. So I ran upstairs, and I started doing some searching in the catalog to see if there had been anything written about military chaplains, about issues of religion in this transition after the Vietnam War. And there hadn't been. Most of what we knew about religion in the Vietnam War centered on anti-war protest, mm-hmm. it seemed. But here was this group of people of faith who were dealing with the after effects of the Vietnam War and had obviously dealt with the Vietnam War itself. And so I went to my advisor, Richard Cohn, who is a saint of a man, mm-hmm. and he said, you have about 3 weeks to come up with a viable master's thesis topic. I'll give you that, but after that, you've got to make a choice one way or the other, or go with the thing that you know.
Yeah.
And so I worked for about 3 weeks feverishly trying to figure out something to do, and it sort of developed from there. And so it really was a serendipitous meeting of finding the documents and finding a source that I thought was really interesting, plus the proverbial gap in scholarship that young scholars and young historians are always looking for and hoping they might stumble across. And I stumbled across one that I think is both interesting and important.
Yeah, that's really the path that so many of us follow. I had the same experience when I was doing my own work, ultimately what evolved into a look at public health and the military at the turn of the century. With regards to your project, though, were there any kind of special challenges that you faced or that you confronted as you began to lay it out, as you went through your research and began to write the book?
I think the most difficult thing was an overwhelming misconception or wrong hypothesis that I started with, and that that I think was pretty pervasive, and I think it remains perhaps the most common misconception that I have to confront with for readers as well, which is that military chaplains operate in worlds that are somehow fundamentally incompatible, that the realm or the world of religion and faith is distinct and collides problematically with the world of the military and the world of war, the realm mm-hmm. of war. And the reasons for this are pretty obvious. In the New Testament Christian scriptures in particular, the emphasis on peace, on loving one's enemy, and all of those things come to mind very, very easily. And so it seems to set up this natural contrast and this natural conflict that military chaplains have to deal with. So when I went into the project, I went in fully expecting to find lots of angst and lots mm-hmm. of conflict and lots of crises of faith and proverbial dark nights of the soul and chaplains really wrestling with theological issues and conflicts and questions. Yeah. And then I just didn't find it. The project actually started with the title A Crisis of Faith, and it kept it for years until probably a month before I turned in the final dissertation and realized that that was actually the opposite of what I was actually arguing, which is that there is fundamentally no crisis of faith that these chaplains experience, or at Right. least that most of them do. So I think that you can have an idea in your head, and it can be perfectly logical and perfectly wrong at the same time, just not borne out in the evidence. So that was a challenge both for me, and I think it's a challenge for readers of the book as well.
Mm-hmm. You know, one thing I noticed when I began reading your book was how you categorize the chaplain as an individual, but also as part of a group that occupies these different crossroads of constantly negotiated and renegotiated status, obligation, and legitimacy within the military. You know, again, not trying to chew too much, but, you know, in my own book, looking at medical officers at the end of the 19th and the early 20th century, I found a very similar kind of series of conflicts and confrontations between medical officers and the military establishment. Can you elaborate on your views about how this takes shape and particularly with reference to how it relates to the Vietnam War?
Sure. I think the question of these dual professional identities, so medical officers, lawyers, chaplains, all of these folks who belong very clearly to two institutional collective identities have some of the same challenges. I think for chaplains, the challenges are perhaps uniquely problematic in that they occupy these liminal spaces or these crossover spaces where their status is contested. And then if they lose credibility with sort of either side, they really do run the risk of becoming ineffective.
Yeah, and that's a constant balancing act as well, you know, to satisfy these two constituencies, I found.
Right, and I think when you have these competing constituencies and these competing ideas about what you're supposed to do and how you're supposed to behave, and you really do have two different perhaps codes of conduct that you're dealing with, and people from the alternate side don't always understand the institutional pressures and the problems and the challenges that someone on the inside of the military perhaps faces. For chaplains, I think the most interesting places of this tension, of this conflict, actually occur where two of their religious ideals sort of come into conflict. So it's not necessarily a military versus religion problem, but actually competing values within one system, so that there are say two religious ideals that come into play, or two military virtues that come into play and are at conflict with each other, that tend to cause the chaplains the most consternation, I guess.
You know, you present in your introduction as well these three archetypes that have captured the public's imagination about the chaplaincy. the saint, the militarist, and the incompetent. Can you comment on those? I mean, you know, are these arbitrary constructions, or you know, are they still relevant, you think?
Sure. I think if you think about when and where you see military chaplains, the first one that almost always comes to mind is Father Mulcahy from the movie or the TV show MASH.
Jocularity.
Yeah. Absolutely. And I will admit that I purchased the box set of MASH and watched all 11 seasons in order and told myself that it was for dissertation research. it was a really fantastic decision. But so we have that image of the chaplain, and actually I think the movie and the TV show present two pretty different images. I'll talk about that in a second. Mm-hmm. But we also maybe remember the chaplain from the novel Billy Budd, or there's a chaplain in Full Metal Jacket, there's a chaplain mentioned in Full Metal Jacket. We don't actually see him. So we have these sort of moments where chaplains are present. And they tend to be sort of in the background. They tend to be secondary characters, but they're a constant feature of modern military life, really.
Right.
And so we have these images, and they tend to center around these three archetypes. So the first one, the idea of the saint, right, who is a willing and sacrificial person who accompanies his troops to the front lines, and who perhaps lays down his own life for the protection of his soldiers. And we have a couple of historical examples that this archetype follows. There were some chaplains in World War II who were on a troop ship that sank in the North Atlantic, the USS Dorchester. And they, you know, mythically, and who knows if the story is true or not, but the story goes that the chaplains offered their life jackets to other people on board. They offered their gloves to soldiers who were getting ready to enter the icy waters, and they held hands and they sang hymns as the ship went down.
Oh, wow.
And there were four chaplains. It was a Catholic, a Jewish chaplain, and two Protestant chaplains. So an ecumenical group who in their last moments tries to provide both physical and spiritual comfort to those around them and act sacrificially. So that's one image. And it's a heartwarming image. It's one that certainly has historical truth to it in terms of chaplains behaving in those ways. But it's an incomplete one. And so the alternative image is the militarist chaplain, right? This is the chaplain who apocryphally at Pearl Harbor grabs one of the naval guns and says, "Praise the Lord and pass the ammunition," and starts firing at Japanese aircraft. This is the chaplain in Full Metal Jacket who says there'll be a magic show at 0930, and he'll tell you all about why God loves Marines, right? And it's because they do the killing for God. And so you have the militarist chaplain who is gung-ho and 100% on board with the military mission. He conflates patriotism and faith and all of those things.
Right.
And so again, you have some historical precedent or some historical truth to that, but it's a much more uncomfortable role. And especially this is the one that critics of the chaplaincy really pull out and really pull on.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have the sort of third model, which is where Father Mulcahy comes in, especially from the film version. The original film of MASH. And this is the chaplain who's a nice guy. Everybody kind of likes him, but he's pretty incompetent because he connects neither with the military side of his culture and institution nor the religious side.
Right.
So the chaplain is unable to prevent the dentist's suicide. He's unable to effect change. He's unable to really have any sort of notable effect on his unit. Father Mulcahy in the TV series is more interesting and more complicated. He is, in my mind, one of the chaplains who sort of defies some of these archetypes and actually presents a much more holistic, complete image of what a chaplain might do. Right? He gambles. He plays poker with the guys, and then also, you know, provides sanctuary to a soldier who's trying to desert, and he's constantly trying to push back on the morality of the war, but he understands that there are limits to the extent that he can do that.
Right.
So in some ways, the TV version of Father Mulcahy provides, I think, an archetypal sort of ideal type for a modern military chaplain.
Right. Well, what always struck me too about Father Mulcahy is how he comes across as much of a humanist as a secularist in his activities and the way he interacts with Hawkeye and the rest of the guys, but then also with the military establishment and the wounded.
Right.
Which again, you know, you don't kind of think of that when you think about a chaplain. So.
You can tell he is a deeply religious man, right? He's a faithful man. He relies on faith and on God in his own sort of personal dealings and personal relationships. But when he is trying to counsel or provide advice to say Hawkeye, he tones it down, right?
Right.
He sort of proverbially meets Hawkeye where he is, and doesn't try to cram religion down their throats and things like that. So he is a presence. His presence provides some stability, some sort of anchoring, some sort of moral grounding to the unit. But it is not necessarily overtly religious at all times.
Right. Right. Well, I mean, there could be an entire book just about Father Mulcahy, I think. But
I think so too. I think I may go back and start rewatching the TV series just for a fun summer project.
There you go. There you go. You know, early in the book, you introduce the context of civil religion, which, as I understand it, is the intersection of this Judeo-Christian mainstream religious consciousness with the dictates of the Cold War American exceptionalist state. How exactly does this civil religion set the stage for American entanglements abroad in the 50s and 60s?
Sure. I think civil religion is a really important concept, both in terms of scholarship and in terms of understanding how the Cold War era actually evolved in terms of America's interactions abroad and with religion within the armed forces. What I think we see in the 1950s, and this is a pretty common story for American history, is that there is a sort of patina of consensus that builds up in this Cold War anti-communist rhetoric, and it is infused with religious language and religious sentiment that is broadly Judeo-Christian, broadly based in a common understanding that religion provides moral grounding, it provides moral guidance, and that the United States is an exemplar of both religious freedoms, but also of a religious heritage. And that what that does for the United States then is to give it authority and credibility in some of its actions abroad. And at home, it gives people a common identity. For Americans, because it is a multiracial, multi-ethnic state, anytime you can find something where relatively diverse groups can come together and find something to agree on, the chances are that public officials, politicians, religious leaders sort of center around that and
right.
glom onto that. And so it provides a common language for the early Cold War period, and it sets the stage very nicely for some of the interventions that America wants to participate in abroad. The problem, and I think the problem that we see in Vietnam, is that, in fact, what looked to be consensus was a sort of hodgepodge of ideas and beliefs, using common language, but undergirded by very different values and very different philosophies.
Mm-hmm.
And so people were using the same words to talk about very, very different things. And so on one hand, you have sort of conservative, more hawkish types who are talking about American exceptionalism in sort of crusading ways. And you have more dovish or more liberal types who are talking about American exceptionalism, meaning very, very different things, simply as being an exemplar, but not necessarily needing to spread it abroad.
Right.
Or you have American conservatives who are speaking about religion with theological specificity, and liberals talking about religion in a very inclusive, non-specific way. And so what Vietnam does is it really brings some of those conflicts to the fore. And so simply using the same language doesn't suffice to hold the center together anymore. And so you see, I think, a disambiguation of civil religious language and civil religious values to set apart two emerging sides of an American political system that's going to start becoming polarized and continue to do so well into the 21st century.
Mm-hmm. What was the Defense Department's posture with regard to the chaplaincy at the onset of the Cold War? And one of the things I'm thinking of is, you know, was there any particular denomination that was favored over others, or any particular outlook that was favored over others?
Sure, that's a great question. So early on, this is developing mostly out of practice rather than out of policy. So practice gets written into policy rather than policy driving the practice. Early on, the chaplaincy was dominated by what we would consider the mainline Christian denominations, and primarily by Episcopalians in particular.
Mm-hmm.
This was a 100-year tradition at least. And so the chaplains came from the largest, most mainstream American denominations. They tended to be fairly moderate in their views, and they tended to be relatively coherent and consistent even across denominational lines.
Mm-hmm.
So that they were roughly interchangeable. And then you also had a really strong contingent all the way across of Catholic chaplains. So throughout the Cold War, what we see is at the beginning a very loose sort of quota system that says our chaplain mm-hmm. corps should basically reflect the religious makeup of the United States. So each church in a sort of annual report or sort of census-like thing reports their membership, and chaplain billets are roughly allocated on that basis. So you're supposed to have about one-third Catholic chaplains, one-third of these mainline Protestant chaplains or liturgical Protestants, so Episcopalians, Presbyterians, Lutherans, etc.
Mm-hmm.
And then about one-third who are from evangelical churches, free churches, or other religions.
Right.
And so that would include, say, some of your Baptist denominations, your Pentecostal denominations, more conservative evangelical groups, but also groups like the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, the Mormons.
Mm-hmm.
So sort of everything else.
Yeah, you describe, you know, the appearance of the Mormon chaplains as kind of like being a source of some internal conflict with the chaplaincy. I mean, I imagine that also mirrors the conflicts within mainstream Christian denominations about the legitimacy of Mormons.
Absolutely, because chaplains are basically interchangeable once they're within these groups, right? So if you have a Catholic chaplain, you can send him anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
If you have a Protestant chaplain, he can fill any Protestant billet that you need.
Mm-hmm.
And so the dispute over Mormon chaplains is whether they rightly count as sort of Protestant everything else chaplains. Because if they do, they can be sent anywhere that one is needed.
Right.
And they may fill a specific billet in which there are no other Protestant chaplains around. If they are separated sort of doctrinally from that mass of everything else chaplains, then you have to account for that in your personnel systems and things like that. It's just more complicated.
Mm-hmm.
And so And the complications are coming from both sides. There are both Christian chaplains who don't wish to see Mormons fill those billets because they think Christian soldiers or sailors' needs are going to go unmet. But you also have limitations on the LDS chaplains because they can't perform Christian sacraments for everyone else, right?
Right.
They can't give, it's not an open communion. They can't give communion to other people. And so there are limitations on both sides. And the dispute is quite vocal and pretty antagonistic for quite a while. It recedes somewhat after the Vietnam War as the number of denominations who send chaplains to the military increases and they figure out how best to deal with these sort of theological and doctrinal differences that place limitations on chaplains. And so the likelihood that you would see a Mormon chaplain stationed somewhere where there wasn't also a Protestant chaplain from a mainline denomination or something would be quite rare.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a major conversation, and there are conversations that aren't unlike what you have when you integrate Jewish chaplains or other faith groups as well.
And that raises two other questions I had too. I mean, the first would be how represented were, or what kind of representation or efforts were made to accommodate African-American denominations, African-American Protestant denominations. And then at the same time, you know, what's the formal position of the American Jewish congregations with reference to the military?
Those are, I think, two really good questions. The question about African-Americans is, on one hand, easy to answer at a very generic, broad level and very difficult to answer at a specific level. The American churches do, historically black churches, do send chaplains, and they usually are black chaplains.
Right.
The difficulty is in, one, telling actually who they are and where they were. The personnel records don't generally record a chaplain's race, and so it's very difficult to tell exactly how many black chaplains deployed to Vietnam, exactly how black soldiers felt about their white chaplains. Races is very, very rarely mentioned in either the official records or the sort of memoirists and diary records that we have from Vietnam. So unless a chaplain is from a historically black church, it's very difficult to tell what his race would have been.
Right.
We do know that the historically black churches were consistently on the low end of their quotas, that the chaplain corps, especially early on, had great difficulty in filling some of the billets that were sort of theoretically assigned to the historically black churches.
Mm-hmm.
The reasons for that are sort of unclear. My hunch is that the black church at the time was so intently focused on civil rights, particularly in the 60s, that sort of sending ministers away, and that was often how it was viewed, was that people sent to the chaplaincy or chaplains were somehow leaving the ministry to go do something else, that was probably not a choice that was looked upon terribly favorably. So you see almost the exact opposite story for Jewish chaplains.
Mm-hmm.
The number of Jews in the American military in terms of a percentage is very, very low. But the number of Jewish chaplains is relatively high. It's much higher than the proportion of Jewish personnel.
Right.
And that has been the case for a couple hundred years, in all honesty. Since the Civil War. There
right.
have been more Jewish chaplains than there have been Jews in the military. And so the National Jewish Welfare Board and other Jewish civic organizations and sort of parachurch organizations think that serving Jews within the military is highly important. They place a significant amount of emphasis on it. They basically drafted rabbis at some points during the war and sent them specifically to the military. They publish an incredible number of publications of guides for lay leaders in the Jewish community, and their Jewish chaplains work very, very hard to gather Jewish personnel in and to maintain a strong Jewish identity even when they are deployed. So you see two very different approaches to how to accommodate, in one case, a minority religious view, and then another, in the other case, to accommodate minority racial and ethnic groups within the military.
Let's shift gears a little bit, focusing then more on Vietnam itself. And, you know, of course, several questions before we even enter the war is, you know, one of them would be, you know, how exactly did the mainstream American religious community view what was taking shape in Vietnam before 1964? And I guess to tack onto that is, you know, is there a consensus one way or another regarding support for the Diem regime? And, you know, did Catholics have a stronger view in this regard than Protestants?
Sure. So before 1964, American religious communities are broadly supportive of U.S. Actions in Vietnam. For the most part, you're going to see religious groups basically tracking and going in parallel with broader public opinion. In some ways, that's I think unsurprising. What you do see is a difference in American Catholic communities and American Protestant communities. Catholics tend to be much stronger and much more vocal in their support of the Diem regime because of his ties to the U.S. Catholic community in particular. So that's fairly clear. On the Protestant side, you do see a conservative liberal divide starting to happen in the mid to late 60s. By the Tet Offensive, by the late 60s, it's pretty well established that the liberal churches are going to take an anti-war position. But up through the 60s, you see lots of national conventions that pass peace resolutions. Everybody says we'd prefer peace, but you know, if violence is necessary, we'll support U.S. troops and soldiers and things like that. And you see a broad support for the freedom of religion, which people agree is being diminished in Vietnam. So you do see support for the war in American religious communities. And that divide does, I think, happen in the late 60s. And there are other authors who have written much more detail than what I do about these specific interreligious debates that are happening in home front communities. And I think it's part of a much broader trend, which I think is very good for Vietnam War scholarship, looking at these home front connections and these home front debates and understanding that they are much more complicated than sort of simply being liberal anti-war views and conservative pro-war views, that they're much more nuanced and much more complicated than we perhaps understood even 10 or 15 years ago.
Right. What were the criteria that were used to select chaplains for service in Vietnam?
Sure. Chaplains have to basically meet two sets of requirements. They have to meet military requirements as well as religious or ecclesial requirements. For the military, chaplains have to meet the basic standards for officers. So they have to pass the physical exam. They have to meet height and weight restrictions, eyesight, things like that, and age. Now, at some points during the Vietnam War, some of those requirements are waivered. Chaplains get waivers for them. So for a while, the Army in particular, looking for Catholic chaplains, let's older chaplains in, or they will waive a height or weight requirement in order to get the type of chaplain that is needed. That's relatively rare, but it does happen. On the religious side, you have to be endorsed by an endorsing agency, which is approved by the military, and they get to set their own standards. Usually the standard is that the chaplain has to have at least 2 years of pastoral experience leading a civilian congregation. They have to have a graduate degree, a Master's of Divinity degree, or a similar degree in, say, psychology or counseling or something like that. Mm-hmm. If the church doesn't have theological education, for example, the Mormons don't have a formal theological seminary type degree, but their chaplains will have degrees in counseling or psychology or something. So you have requirements from both sides. Some churches require chaplains sign, say, a statement of faith and belief. Others don't. So it's widely varying on that. But if you don't meet both sets of requirements, you are ineligible for chaplain service.
What about in the case of conscription? I mean, you mentioned that rabbis were subject to conscription. I mean, in the first case, first question, I guess, would be, were other denominations subject to conscription? And did that alter then the formula for consideration?
Well, so when I say conscription, they were basically conscripted by their religious community.
Ah, okay.
So it's the clergy are all exempt from the draft.
I thought
As are seminary students.
Right.
So that was a sort of misspeaking on my side. But they are rabbis are basically drafted into service by their religious community.
Right.
And told you will go serve as a chaplain.
Okay.
And so what this means is that the chaplains I'm talking about in the book are all really, with very few exceptions, are all self-selected. None of them had to go to Vietnam. None of them had to be military chaplains. Again, with the exception of those couple, a few rabbis, a handful.
Okay.
And so what this does, as with any self-selected group, it by and large weeds out anyone who simply couldn't in good conscience serve in the military. It takes away an entire question even to be asked, because the people most likely to ask the question would have never been military chaplains in the first
place. Okay. How do the chaplains interact with the local population once they arrived?
Sure. It varied widely. It depended on where chaplains were based. It depended on when they were serving there. Of course, the Vietnam War is very, very long. And so chaplain interactions with locals in, say, 65 are going to be quite different than they will be in 1972.
Mm-hmm.
If you're down in the Delta, it's going to be a little bit different than if you're up near the DMZ. So the wishy-washy answer is it depends. The more specific answer is that most chaplains thought that developing ties with the religious community or the community at large in Vietnam was an important part of both their work as a minister, but also an important part of the American military mission.
Right.
And so chaplains would link up with their units to do civil action programs. They would link up, they would help put their units in touch with the orphanages or schools.
Right.
And they would do projects there, whether that be digging wells or health clinics or building schools.
Yeah.
Lots of examples of chaplains taking up offering money to buy chickens, to provide clothes and supplies for schools and orphanages and for local churches as well.
I'm sure they're also actively involved in the Hamlet project, you know, the resettlement project.
Yeah, to some extent. And chaplains tended to want to act in more unofficial capacities in forming these relationships, because they were a little bit wary of creating long-term official relationships that couldn't be sustained over time.
Right.
And so chaplains tend to act in these unofficial capacities, but they do participate in some of the official programs as well.
Okay. Were they considered a target by the NLF or the MVA? Were they treated as non-combatants?
So the laws of war say chaplains are non-combatants, and the U.S. does take measures to make sure that they are fulfilling their Geneva Convention requirements. But it is a pretty significant worry of American chaplains that if they are captured, that they will be killed as basically a political officer,
right,
in the army. Now, we don't really have much evidence of this actually happening, and so it widely operates in the realm of sort of myth about what might happen,
right,
how the enemy might treat chaplains.
So for the most part, the North, you know, respected the sanctity of the chaplaincy.
As far as the documents allow us to tell at this point. So again, it's hard to say with 100% certainty, but you also see relatively few chaplains taken prisoner. And I think part of this is protective measures that the U.S. takes. There are commanders, if they are concerned about chaplains being taken prisoner, then they tend to do one of two things. Either they will allow a chaplain to carry a weapon for self-defense and things like that, or they will not allow the chaplain to go out on the front lines, and they'll keep the chaplain back at headquarters or at a hospital or something like that, where it's easier to protect him. Those are decisions that individual chaplains and individual commanders make, on a day-to-day, mission-to-mission basis about the chaplain's security, what the risk to the unit is if an unarmed chaplain is with them. And people, they come to a wide variety of answers about how best to deal with the potential of being taken prisoner, being captured.
Okay. How does the American rank and file respond to the presence and activities of the chaplains in Vietnam?
So, for the most part, American soldiers, airmen, sailors, and Marines they appreciate chaplains being there, but they don't tend to see them as a decisive factor in either their morale or their well-being, or in their ability to accomplish the military mission. I think chaplains provide a link to home, a link to sort of comforting traditions that they experienced, whether that be singing familiar hymns or receiving communion. And so what we see from post-war surveys, and I also see it in the memoir literature and diaries and letters, are soldiers being deeply appreciative of the chaplain's presence, but talking very, very little about anything overtly or specifically theological or religious that the chaplains did.
Right.
And so you see, for example, you know, a chaplain will visit an outpost, and everyone in the unit will come to the service, regardless of whether they are religious or not. It provides them a break. It provides them some solace and some sense of community. But the specific religious content in combat is relatively low.
Right.
It's much more about presence and about the sense of community than it is about a specific religious idea or religious belief.
Mm-hmm. Okay. You know, as a matter of course, you know, chaplains are frequently placed in conflicting circumstances in wartime. You know, I'm thinking of issues with staff off, you know, they're considered the staff officers who are responsible to line or other staff superiors. But then, as you note as well, they're also the primary advocates for disaffected soldiers in all grades.
Mm-hmm.
You know, are there clear cases of a personal internal conflict within or among chaplains over balancing these types of relationships?
Again, I think chaplains feel most conflicted when two sort of religious dictates are rubbing up against each other, or two military dictates are rubbing up against each other.
Mm-hmm.
So these are the conflicts that I think are most likely to cause chaplains some sort of angst, right? Is when they understand their duty as a staff officer to the commander to uphold their oath and things like that, but they do also see themselves structurally in a position to advocate for the disaffected, for soldiers who are disconnected or having difficulty adjusting or things like that. Mm-hmm. And so I do think they feel conflict within those terms. On the religious side, I think you have a similar thing, where they are, on one hand, supposed to uphold the morality, the virtue, the religious dictates of their community, and at the mm-hmm. same time, they are supposed to display empathy and compassion, and be present for soldiers, and they understand that those two can sometimes come into conflict. So it's not necessarily a military religious problem. It's, I think, conflict internal to institutions and organizations that can cause chaplains, I think, the most significant psychological.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. How do they respond to the growing use of marijuana and the harder drugs, narcotics in the ranks? I mean, do they see it as a personal failing on the part of the soldier? Do they see it as, indicative of a larger rot in the institution?
I think, especially late in the war, so by the time 1970 through 73 roll around, chaplains are quite concerned with what they see as sort of moral rot within the military. They mm-hmm. tend to... This is speaking very broadly, they tend to peg it to institutional and systemic concerns mm-hmm. rather than personal moral failings, which I think is interesting. I think that is not going to be the language used by many religious communities in the later 70s and into the 1980s. Where it's a sign of moral failure or character failure. Rather, they see the institutional pressures. They see the degradation that war has caused.
Right.
And they tend to peg it there. Similarly, if you look at chaplains' post-war dealings, especially for chaplains who were stationed in Germany, with a lot of returning Vietnam veterans, and of course there they have rampant drug use, race riots, and all sorts of problems there.
Right.
The chaplains are identifying institutional and systemic problems that are in some ways indicative of broader cultural problems that they see in the United States and a moral failing on the whole,
sure.
rather than on individual soldiers. They don't tend to blame individual soldiers for those things.
Mm. What about the responses to the claims or the evidence of war atrocities being committed by American troops? Again, how do they respond to that?
On the whole, very badly, in that they tend to not respond. And this is, I think, one of the most interesting and one of the most difficult things that I wrote about. Chaplains do confront evidence that American troops are committing war crimes or atrocities, and sort of which word you use depends on sometimes on the evidence and the circumstance, and sometimes on how you want to whether you want to prosecute them and things like that.
Right.
Chaplains do sometimes see evidence of it. They rarely see it themselves. When they witness it themselves, they are more likely to say something or to do something,
uh-huh.
but when they hear about it secondhand, it becomes problematic for them to say anything. The problem tends to be that they value personal relationships with soldiers. They think their entire credibility, their entire job, is based on their ability to connect at a personal level to soldiers or Marines or whomever it is that they are serving.
Yeah.
And if they say something, then they to a higher commander, then their credibility as a confidant, their credibility as a counselor, as an empathetic ear, will be totally lost.
Yeah.
And so they are deeply concerned with that, and they frame it in the realm of pastoral confession and confidentiality. And they think, and they still do, they think those rules are set and inviolable. They cannot, they are unwilling to bend rules about confidentiality, because if they lose that credibility, they think they will have no more ministry at all.
Right. I mean, it's so interesting when you describe it. You're also talking about a community then who, at the same time as you discussed, they're trying to conduct outreach to the local population as well. I mean, I'm just thinking about the internal conflicts that this creates.
Yeah, it's hugely problematic, not only for that reason, right, that they're trying to conduct outreach, that they have specific examples of American soldiers breaking down those relationships that they're trying to build up. They have the issue of their relationships with American service members, and then they have their duty to commanding officers. And these things often do, I think, require them to make really uncomfortable decisions. Sometimes they have an overwhelming sense that their commander doesn't want to hear it.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And so if the commander wants to look the other way and the chaplain is constantly bringing it up, right, talking about potential atrocities or potential.
He becomes a squeaky wheel. Yeah.
And he loses his credibility with the commander. Mm. So, you know, how exactly the chaplain is supposed to navigate it is quite unclear. They operate with almost no guidance on the issue. They operate with very little, there's very little talk about it. There's very little documentation or writing or, you know, clearly you don't write this sort of thing down. And so they're for the most part totally on their own. And I think ultimately many of them are, after the war, deeply troubled by the decisions they made during wartime.
Well, I was going to say, I'm sorry.
I wish I had said something. I should have said something. Yeah. I just didn't know what to do. I didn't know how to deal with it. And so I think you do see a clear example of chaplains making, at best, morally suspect decisions. I don't think it's fair to them to say that they had forsaken their religious duty or their religious identity by making those decisions. I think they were using a different frame of reference. They were emphasizing their pastoral role, their institutional role as a minister to American service members and to an American sort of institution that wasn't that in which they wouldn't be effective if they were to speak loudly and to vocalize their moral misgivings about the conduct of the war.
Do we have any sense of, I mean, again, I don't want to overdraw this issue. There's a couple of questions I have, but again, it's so fascinating. Is there any sense of how many chaplains would have sought counseling or would have considered them or have reported themselves as, you know, being afflicted with PTSD even years after? I mean, I don't know how you would quantify that, but it just strikes me as for them such an eternal crisis that they couldn't come through it unscathed, just regardless of their faith.
Difficult to quantify. I think what we do see, and these are based on patterns of reading lots of survey data, lots of, again, memoirs and diaries and looking at post-war conferences and things like that. Chaplains deal with the trauma of war on the whole better than their enlisted counterparts, for sure, and better than the officer corps at large. And the psychologists will tell us that this is because chaplains have more coping mechanisms. Mm-hmm. They have more strategies in terms of resilience and things like that.
Right.
And so they're better able to deal with it. Chaplains tend to write a lot during their deployments. So they're basically practicing in the tradition of spiritual autobiography or trauma writing, which we know is therapeutic. They tend to have more religious resources. They tend to have a sort of deeper understanding of theology and faith. And they also tend to be older,
right?
Which helps their right. resiliency. On the flip side, if a chaplain does experience that intense conflict, that intense crisis of faith, it can be deeply damaging.
Yeah.
I only have a couple of examples of that happening, where a chaplain sort of loses his faith or walks away from the church or is unable to deal with his experiences during the war. Mm-hmm. But those examples are pretty striking.
Right.
And they're extreme. Most chaplains, though, stay in the ministry. Most chaplains continue to be ardent practitioners of their mm-hmm. faith. They tend to view things through a spiritual lens. They tend to see their time in Vietnam as being part of a greater plan, even if they think the Vietnam War itself was wrong and immoral and problematic.
Right.
They as a group find redemption in their experience, which I think is, to me, was both interesting and unexpected. Mm-hmm. Because you expect them to really struggle with some of these conflicts, and they tend to work them out in religiously specific ways that make sense of the war and their place in it.
Right. You know, the growing influence, we're moving to after the war now, the growing influence of conservative evangelical denominations after Vietnam in the chaplaincy. Do you think that was a result of the war itself, or did that reflect other trends in society?
I think it's, for the most part, reflecting other trends, but I think the war amplifies some of those trends.
Mm-hmm.
So the so-called rise of the religious right, this story, I think, basically parallels that. It doesn't predate it or anything mm-hmm. like that. But what the war does is it very starkly puts people into camps.
Right.
And what we see by the end of the war is that liberal and mainline churches, which have taken institutional stands against the war by the late 60s and early 70s, basically stop sending military chaplains to serve in Vietnam. They stop coming to the fight. It's not a fight that they lose. They just stop showing up. They basically mm-hmm. forfeit and cede the ground. And so what you see over time is a diminishment of the quota system, because mainline churches can't fill their billets. Catholic churches are having difficulty filling Catholic chaplain positions.
Mm-hmm.
And you have evangelical, more conservative groups who are clamoring, banging at the door to get more chaplains in. And they make a decision that having a chaplain is more important than having a chaplain of a specific denomination.
Mm-hmm.
And so you see a huge influx in terms of numbers of conservative and evangelical groups that's pretty firmly established by the mid-70s, so in that immediate post-war era. And so the Vietnam War basically takes liberal and mainline chaplains out of this ongoing conversation
mm-hmm.
that's happening nationally, and it takes them out of the conversation that's happening specifically within the military.
Mm-hmm.
And it takes years. It's not until really probably the last 5 years, so well into the 21st century, that liberal and mainline churches start to reverse this trend and reverse this decision and actually start
right.
actively sending chaplains back into the military and going,
right.
we should have never given up that ground. And so now some of them are slowly trying to claw some of that back.
Right. It's certainly a generational change. I mean, it seems like an older generation that was aware of or that immediately responded to the Vietnam War had to age and clear out of the way, I guess. I don't know.
yeah, I think that's part of it. I think the liberal strand of American religion has always wanted to play a more prophetic role in society in terms of speaking truth to power, calling out sort of moral failings and things like that. And that's a difficult role to play in the military for all the reasons that we've talked about. In the military, chaplains tend to play a pastoral role. They tend to play a priestly role, if you sort of divide it into Max Weber's categories. They are they're there to provide comfort and to provide religious services and sacraments to the people who are there. And so it's a tradition that liberal churches and mainline churches now are starting to sort of pick back up on and to understand the difficulty of prophetic ministry within the chaplaincy as it's constituted now, and wanting to really get back in. Mm-hmm. And try to affect social change and sort of shift the worldview of some of the chaplains.
Yeah, exert a more moderating influence.
Yeah, a more moderate voice, and you have the demographic changes with the all volunteer force in the mid-70s, and then the demographic changes that continue now, where for enlisted personnel in particular, more and more and more of them are unaffiliated with a church tradition. They're unaffiliated with a specific religious denomination. They will call themselves spiritual or not, but not religious. Or they'll say, I'm sort of vaguely Christian, but don't have any particular religious belief. This is what the demographers call the rise of the nuns in O-N-E-S.
Right.
Broadly in society, and the number of those within the military is growing very, very rapidly. Some estimates are that today it's between 25% and 30% are unaffiliated. And so interestingly, the religious denominations who are most amenable to the idea of a sort of generic version of spirituality or a more universalist bent tend to come from the mainline and liberal side of the spectrum, and they're precisely the ones who haven't had chaplains in the military not many chaplains. It's not that there were zero; there were just very few.
Right.
And so they're starting to see that ceding the field to the more conservative side is problematic, and so they're actively trying to reverse some of those decisions.
Okay. Well, Jacqueline, we're nearing the end of the interview, and as a result, there are those last two questions I asked that aren't necessarily related to your book that we ask everybody. And I guess first, what are you reading now? What kind of nonfiction are you engrossed by that's work-related?
Well, the not work-related is tough. I have, in the last 2 years, I've become a professor of security studies and strategy, so my history reading has suffered greatly. But I am, the books I've got on my desk right now. I have The Politics of American Foreign Policy by Peter Grice.
Oh, okay.
And this one is, in another course, it is sort of work-related, but I think it's interesting. We talk a lot about political polarization in the United States, and this is with our international officers that I teach. And so this one is about how ideology, liberal and conservative ideology, affects American foreign policy. So that's been an interesting read of late. And then I also have a book of essays, which I'm enjoying quite a lot, by Jill Lepore, called The Story of America. And this is about different myths and literally stories that we tell about American history and how it winds the past and the present together. So I'm enjoying that quite a bit. And then the last one I have on my desk is called The Unwinding by George Packer. So this is another collection of essays from a journalist and sort of pundit commentator about recent American history, about American democracy, and what that might mean for the current state of affairs. So that's my light summer reading.
Okay. Take it to the beach with you when you go.
They're all paperback, so it's fine.
Good, good, good. Second question is, what are you thinking about for your next project?
Sure. I've got two things sort of cooking right now. One is a collection of short essays that I'm writing about sort of updating what I wrote in the book about religion in the contemporary American military. So talking about issues of religious freedom, of establishment, of minority religions in the military. So looking at the treatment of, say, Sikhs or Wiccans, looking at the contemporary chaplain corps, looking at the end of Don't Ask, Don't Tell and how that has played out. So just sort of short things. And I'm slowly but surely working away on those. And then the second project is much broader and much more conceptual, but it has to do with the relationship of narrative and storytelling to the creation of American strategy. Mm. Thinking about the way that we frame conflict, the way that we frame strategic choices in narrative form, and how that affects and shapes our foreign policy choices that we seem to have in front of us.
Right.
I think storytelling is a pretty powerful tool that humans use to make sense of the world around us. And I think by understanding the stories that we choose to tell, by understanding the narrative frameworks that we use, we can start to see how strategy is formed and what the consequences of those various stories we tell are.
Wow.
Because for every story we choose to tell, for every story about the communist menace or about terrorism or whatever, we are actively choosing not to tell a myriad of other stories that are potentially out there.
Well, it sounds like you're taking a page.
That's the other thing.
Wow, it sounds like you're taking a page out of Frank Castigliola's book with that.
Yes.
That's great.
A little bit. But there's lots of interesting stuff. There's political scientists working on some of the stuff. There's literary theory, and it's been very exciting and interdisciplinary and the perfect sort of second project.
Well, that's a book I really look forward to reading. I hope I can
We'll see when I can get a sabbatical. That's the next challenge.
Okay. Well, let's hope that doesn't take too long. Jacqueline, thank you very much for joining me today.
Absolutely. It's been a pleasure.
That's great. And on behalf of New Books in Military History, this is Bob Wintermute thanking all of our listeners for tuning in.